Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards, thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwanga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm joined by our co-host Mona Hill.
Hi,
Good morning, Mona.
Happy to be here.
And today we're following up on a previously aired program featuring the 2010 National Restorative Justice Symposium held in Regina. The symposium featured workshops that are focused on Aboriginal justice, youth, schools, families, national and international developments, victim issues, and the future of restorative justice. Our guests today have a definitive interest in restorative justice. Barbara Tomporowski, who was a member of the planning committee for the symposium, and Kelly Stankiewicz, who is the coordinator of the Voice Project for the Regina Alternative Measures Program. So good morning to the two of you.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Welcome,
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, it's good to have you. So welcome back, everybody. It's nice to be here on this warmer day than we've had. Wow, I didn't even plug the car in last night. It was great.
It was fun driving, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A little slippery up there.
Yeah, it was. So we're going to split the show in half. This is, as Jim said, this is a follow-up to the show that we did back in November on the Restorative Justice Symposium. And Barbara agreed to come back and give us a bit of an update on how it went. And Kelly is here, as she was one of the presenters, and she's here on behalf of RAMP, or the Regina Alternative Measures Program. So we're going to hear a little bit about the future of restorative justice from her perspective as well. So, Barbara, what would you like to tell us about how the conference went?
We really appreciated being invited here to speak to your listeners about the symposium early in November, and I'm really thankful that you invited us back to talk about how it went. I'm so pleased to say that the symposium was a resounding success.
Oh, wonderful.
Historically, it's been attended by about 150 or 160 people from across Canada, but the planning committee's goal was to have 200 to 300 people attend, and we knew it was ambitious to try and double the attendance, but we went for it, and we more than succeeded. We ended up with 330 registrants.
Wow.
We finally had to close registration, and we're sad that we had to turn people away. So it was extremely successful from a registration perspective, and I think that speaks to the growing interest in restorative justice across the country. It was also successful in terms of the quality of workshops and the plenary sessions. We had evaluation forms, and we aren't finished writing up the reports on this yet, but the evaluation forms show that people thought it was well organized and that the quality of workshops was very good. I'd like to talk a little bit about the two plenaries, which were really quite interesting. The first one was about the past, present, and future of restorative justice in Canada. And our two plenary speakers for that were Don Worm, who's a lawyer in Saskatoon, who's now the lead counsel for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, and Jamie Scott, who was the coordinator of the Collaborative Justice Project in Ottawa, which is a restorative justice project that deals with serious offenses and has also done work on developing to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So Don Worm talked about the important advances that have been made in the Aboriginal justice field, but he argued that the concepts of restorative justice should be applied to all people. And he spoke about the continuing issues with the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in the criminal justice system and the need to continue making progress on that front and to expand the use of restorative justice.
I just wanted to interject with a question. When he was suggesting that restorative justice should be available to all people, has it not been in the past?
He was speaking specifically about a provision in the criminal code called the Gladue provision, which we hear about in the news periodically, and that's a provision which talks about how a judge in sentencing should consider circumstances that bring the offender before the court with particular attention to the needs of Aboriginal people. That provision has been interpreted by the Supreme Court of Canada as being in support of restorative justice. Restorative justice is used for people all over Canada, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, in many cases. But what he was saying is that that there's a need to consider the provisions of restorative justice more broadly in all kinds of cases.
Thank you.
Jamie Scott spoke about his experience with the past, present, and future of restorative justice, his experience in developing one of the early programs that dealt with serious cases of violence using restorative justice, and then how restorative justice programs have been expanding across the country. And he ended with a call for restorative justice practitioners to try and put out a positive vision for criminal justice and to try and bring forward suggestions about how we could address issues such as overrepresentation in the justice mm-hmm. system. So those were really interesting opening plenaries. And then the second plenary was on victim issues in restorative justice. And for that one, our two keynote speakers were Dave Gustafson, who coordinates the Community Justice Initiatives Program in BC, which is another program that deals with extremely serious cases of violence through restorative justice, cases such as murder, sexual assault, and robbery, and so on. And he had with him a victim of a terribly tragic case, a lady who was attacked by a family member. She was almost killed, and some of her children were killed in this attack. Mm-hmm. She was involved in going through the Community Justice Initiatives program, and she spoke about the impact of that program. She said that it changed her life. And what was particularly interesting about that plenary session is that Dave brought, with her permission, the victim's permission, brought the scores on a tool that he uses when he works with victims that measures their level of post-traumatic stress disorder. So your listeners might know that people who are victimized often have recurring nightmares, flashbacks, and right. other kinds of symptoms as a result of the trauma they've suffered. So he gives this particular measuring tool to victims before they participate in the program and after. And with her permission, he showed the results. And the results showed that just 1 week after participating, this lady's nightmares and flashbacks and so on had really substantially diminished. And within 6 months, she reported that they had evaporated.
Wow.
So he says he's seen those results in many cases, and that's one piece of evidence about the potential for restorative justice to be used in appropriate cases with victims who want to participate. And in a little while, I'd like Kelly to talk a bit about that, because this new program that she's involved in developing will be a program here in Saskatchewan which will handle more serious matters of all kinds using restorative justice. We also had 23 workshops. Jim, at the opening of the program, talked about the range of workshops. All kinds of topics were covered, everything from bullying to... there was a documentary by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation on healing for survivors of residential schools. That was a really powerful documentary called The Red Road Forward by Brett Bradshaw. I encourage all of your listeners to see that.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Kelly, would you like to say anything from your perspective about what it was like to participate in the symposium and to present a workshop there?
Presenting a workshop there, it was great. It was wonderful. I got the word out. I told people about my program. We presented right after Dave Gustafson and his victim, and we were hoping to let people know that the VOICE program is going to be dealing with serious offenses, not quite as serious, but we're hoping to have the same kind of effect with victims as he had with his.
Yeah, I felt, Kelly, that there was a tremendous sense of energy and excitement at this event. When I go to national events, I often see how people who are involved in the restorative justice movement are just so committed to this work, but they often feel, I think, that they're very alone. A lot of people work in rural and northern programs where they don't have much opportunity to interact with other colleagues in the field. They often feel, I think, that they're struggling against... philosophies of punishment and so on, and that they're trying to put forward something new that people aren't familiar with, and that can sometimes perhaps be a bit lonely. So I think that people at the symposium really appreciated that opportunity to network. That's certainly the results we saw in the evaluation forums. What did you feel about the kind of energy and excitement there during the event?
It was wonderful. It felt like everyone was part of a family. Everybody was close to each other. We were able to joke around. There were people who were asking questions about justice and not being dealt with properly, and we were hoping that we would be able to help the victims out and deal with their problems in a more restorative way.
One thing I wanted to touch on that you mentioned was ideologies, perhaps, of feeling very alone. Even whether you're up north or whether you're working in a city, I think this has become probably more of an issue in our country than it has in the past with the direction that our governments have been taking toward building more prisons and towards more punitive actions with criminals. Are you finding it more difficult now with this type of thought process than in the past? Or, you know, what do you think about that?
I think that the level of support for restored justice varies a lot across the country, and I certainly can't speak on behalf of the federal government. I would say from my own experience dealing with practitioners and officials across the country that there are some places, or some provinces and territories where there's a huge amount of restored justice going on, mm-hmm. where people in the justice system are extremely supportive, and I'm so proud to say that Saskatchewan is one of those places. Here, the government puts in a lot of funding. Overall, between the federal and provincial governments, I think it's about $6 million a year,
okay.
which is astounding. And as a result of that, we have restorative justice and Aboriginal justice programs across most of the province.
Mm-hmm.
Many people working in this field doing such great work with the help of the University of Regina, the University of Saskatchewan, faith groups, and other community groups and schools. So Saskatchewan is one place where there's a lot of restorative justice going on, and there are other provinces and territories, too, where that is happening. In other places, it's newer, more developmental, or perhaps doesn't have that same level of funding support,
mm-hmm.
so it varies a lot.
Okay. You talked about the various areas that there were presenters, and one of the things I thought I'd ask about would be victim issues in restorative justice. And, you know, you mentioned the post-traumatic stress disorder sort of study that they did and how that seems to be minimized or diminishes quite a bit after going through a mediation. Is that the process? Is that what has made the difference for victims? Was it a mediation process or what was it?
In a minute, maybe I'll ask Kelly to speak from her experience as a practitioner who works in these kind of cases.
Oh, wonderful.
I could talk a little bit, though, about the research and how these programs are generally structured.
Mm-hmm.
Victim-offender mediation, where a victim and offender meet with a facilitator, is probably the most common restorative justice process, but there are others. Often the facilitators might bring in family members, community members, justice officials, and others. And those processes are sometimes called circles or family group conferences and so
right.
on. The overall research shows that participating in restorative justice has about a 12% decrease in recidivism associated with it, and that victims and offenders who participate in these programs are generally very happy with their experience. I suspect that part of the reason why restorative justice processes can help to meet the needs of victims who want to participate is because the facilitators really try to work hard to spend a lot of time working with the victim and the offender before the process to make sure they understand all the dynamics in the case, to make sure that the offender's there for the right reason so that they don't re-victimize that victim, to make sure the victim's really ready to meet the person if they wish to do so, the person who's really maybe harmed them
mm-hmm.
deeply. And also that the facilitators are trained to spend a lot of time listening and really trying to help those people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's the key to a successful restored justice encounter is actually that whole process of preparation before those two people even engage in any kind of dialogue. And then, again, things can happen during the encounter, so the facilitator has to be prepared to address anything that might arise. I think, in other words, it's more the process of preparation and really caring about and working with these people that makes the difference more than, an actual hour, 2 hours, or however many hours they might spend together in that face-to-face meeting.
Right. So we're talking about building relationships and creating trust.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very valuable, obviously.
Kelly, would you like to say anything as a facilitator of these kinds of cases?
I have had cases where the people needed to have a lot of time spent with each of them, and I felt a lot of tension going into the room when we were bringing everybody together.
Mm-hmm.
After everybody has a chance to talk, and we allow people to talk without interruption, that's what the facilitator is there for. We have to stay neutral, but we have to make sure that nobody interrupts anybody else. Everybody has their say. Everybody gets to ask questions. Everybody gets to explain what they were thinking at the time. And a lot of that tension is gone from the room. Laughter and hugs and, you know, happiness result.
Really?
So, yeah, a lot of times. Not always, but a lot mm-hmm. of times it does.
Wow.
Understanding.
I would think that's proof that it kind of works. If you can occasionally run into some laughter and hugs in something mm-hmm. like this. Wow. One of the things I noticed on the website as I was doing some research was restorative justice in prisons. Did you cover any of that at the symposium? Was there any conversation about that or any presentations?
There weren't very many workshops that touched on that specifically. The Correctional Service of Canada has a federal program called Restorative Opportunities, which provides mediation in cases with federally sentenced offenders.
Okay.
I don't work directly with that program. I'm not a federal official. But their officials were there, and they spoke about that during one of the workshops.
Okay.
I know that the federal government, the Correctional Service of Canada, has also tried to implement restorative justice programs in probation and in a prison setting in Alberta, I believe. I don't think that's active at this point. In my personal view, expanding more into the correctional system is one place that that we could certainly do more work in the future. I think something else that's really important and exciting is the work that's being done with Circles of Support and Accountability. And Kelly volunteers with one of those programs. The Circles of Support and Accountability are groups of volunteers who provide supervision and guidance to high-risk sex offenders when they're released. And as your listeners can probably imagine, these are the kind of people who often create the most fear and concern in communities. And the research about these circles, which are groups that are provided with training by the Correctional Service of Canada and which have assistance and advice from the police, corrections workers, officials, and mental health groups and others. Like, I sit on a steering committee for these groups, so I'm familiar with their work.
Okay.
I think that these groups do such tremendously important work to keep communities safe in a very practical way because they're trying to ensure that people who do cause a lot of fear and who have committed often terrible acts that have deeply, mm-hmm. deeply traumatized others, mm-hmm. that these people are held accountable for keeping to conditions that will ensure that they do not reoffend and keep the community safer. So the work of people like Kelly as a volunteer and sitting on these groups is one incredibly important way that community members can make a difference in keeping communities safer. The evidence from COSAs, there's been a couple of studies, one provincial study in another province than Saskatchewan, suggests that people, offenders who have these circles, have a 70% less reoffending rate overall, and that's really quite astounding.
That is so significant.
Yeah, so there aren't very many groups across the country doing this. I think there's about 16 COSA projects across the province, one of which is here in Regina.
Ray, I'm waiting to get a call back so I can get someone from COSA on the show. I think it's so important.
Yeah, Kelly, would you like to say anything about your experience as a volunteer in a COSA group?
I think it's fabulous. And everybody in the circle there becomes friends, and not only are we holding the offender accountable for his actions, we're each held accountable for our own as well. It's kind of like a evening every week that I look forward to going out for coffee with some friends.
Okay. This is an area that myself as a social worker, I've had to really do some serious thinking about at times with some of the people that I've worked with. The first principle of my profession is recognizing and upholding the inherent worth and dignity of all people. And some people question that when it comes to serious sex offenders, you know, people who commit horrendous, what we would consider to be horrendous crimes in our country. And so this is a challenge for, I think, for everyone to be able to look at someone who has committed those serious offenses and caused so much trauma and caused so much grief as having inherent worth and dignity. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like what you're doing is recognizing that, and that is how you do this, is that every individual has this, mm-hmm. regardless of what they've done, and that they deserve to have someone there for them if they're going to come back and become members of society that are appreciated and they can contribute to the best of their ability. So congratulations on doing that. I'd like to hear more about that if you have more to say.
Sure. Well, I think that there's been a lot of people who don't understand how I could go for coffee with these people, and why would you do that? And it's kind of I don't look at these people as people who have committed horrendous crimes. I look at them as people just like I am, and I've had trauma in my life, and you get through it. And so if anybody in the group is going through a traumatic experience, we help each other out, and we discuss things right from scratch. And like I said, I don't look at people as being from the crimes that they've committed. I look at people from inside, from mm-hmm. who they are inside.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing now.
I think the concept of how do you connect human rights to restorative justice, that's one of the ways that you do it,
mm-hmm.
is by looking at people from what's inside.
Good.
Wonderful. We got 5 minutes left. What else would you like to talk about, Barb? Tell us a little bit more about how the conference went.
Another aspect of the symposium was that there was a banquet where the National Ron Weeb Restorative Justice Award was presented. And this is an annual award that goes back, I think, at least 10 years. And there's a national selection committee that picks a person or a group who receives the award every year. And this year's award went to Dr. Liz Elliott in British Columbia. She is involved in founding the Center for Restorative Justice at Simon Fraser. And so Liz was there to receive the award, along with many other recipients who were honored in the presentation. We were so pleased that the Commissioner of the Correctional Service of Canada, Don Head, attended the ceremony and presented that award, and also the Minister of Justice for Saskatchewan, Minister Don Morgan, attended and gave the opening speech during the opening ceremony, as well as many other dignitaries.
Mm-hmm.
So we had really good support from both federal and provincial officials, and many people felt that the banquet and the award ceremony was one thing that they really enjoyed and appreciated about the event. One thing that was quite interesting about the banquet was that we had a lady named Sandy Pelchet come and speak about her mother's experience as a Métis woman whose community was forcibly moved to Green Lake in northern Saskatchewan, I think in the 1940s or 1950s. And that's an aspect of Saskatchewan history that many people were not familiar with. And her mother, Sandy, told her mother's story in her mother's own words, accompanied with photographs, and that presentation was so moving that there were actually people in tears in the audience. So we wanted to highlight the contributions of Métis people at the symposium, because 2010 was the year of the Métis Nation in Canada, and we thought it was quite important for people to hear about this aspect of Saskatchewan history that many weren't familiar with. And of course it worked with our interest in talking about other Aboriginal issues, such as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and residential schools.
Right, right. Wow. What was the award given to Liz? What was Liz's last name?
Elliott. Dr.
Liz Elliott. What was it given to her for? What work has she done?
Well, she's been instrumental in really promoting the use of restorative justice in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
She does a lot of work with volunteer nonprofit groups who are doing restorative justice there, and also in supporting academic research through the Center for Restorative Justice at Simon Fraser.
Okay, wonderful. How much time we got left, Jim?
Oh, about 2.5.
2.5 minutes. We need to fill it up. Okay.
I was just going to comment that it seems to me the key to all this is maintaining positive engagement with offenders. You know, what happens when you say let somebody out of the prison doors, whatever, when they leave jail, if they don't have a positive engagement with society, then they're going to sort of revert back to old habits and you're back to square one.
Yeah, that's certainly one important aspect of restored justice, but it's also equally about meeting the needs of victims and about engaging community members. So these processes that we've been talking about are ways for communities to have a real practical say in keeping communities safer and resolving conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Kelly and I work in the criminal justice side of restorative justice, I'd like your listeners to know that there's restorative justice in many other areas, in workplaces. It's really growing in schools, both in Canada and in other countries.
Right, you were talking about there being presentations on bullying.
Exactly, and the use of restorative justice and mediation, peer mediation even, to resolve conflicts between students or teachers and students and so on. And also, there's a growing interest in restorative justice as a philosophy about how people should live in all aspects of their life. So the criminal justice is one important side, but there's many others.
That's very interesting. I don't think most people consider that to be part of the rest of society other than the criminal justice system. So we're here with Barbara Tomprowski, who's a member of the Planning Committee for the 2010 National Restorative Justice Symposium, and we're doing an update on it. Barbara is a senior policy analyst with the Ministry of Justice and Attorney General, and she co-chairs the Federal Provincial Territorial Working Group on Restorative Justice. She works on national, provincial, and local justice initiatives, and currently Barbara, who has a master's in sociology, teaches classes at the Department of Justice Studies at the U of Regina. And we'll be back after, and we'll be talking to Kelly Stankiewicz, who's the coordinator of the VOICE, or Voice Program, Project for the Regina Alternative Measures Program. And Kelly's worked as a counselor at First Nations Battered Women's Shelter in Yorkton, and she started working for the RAMP program in 2007. And Kelly is also a fellow social worker and has a master's of adult education. And she provides supervised access visits and personal home care for a cognitively impaired adult and volunteers on a circle of support and accountability every week. So we'll come back after this message, and we'll play some good music, too, for you.
You bet.
Thank you. Here's a song I hope you'll like about us all getting together and bringing peace to the world.
Are we back yet?
And we're back. Okay. That was B.B. King, if you didn't know, live at San Quentin. That was in 1990. So for the B.B. King fans out there.
He was at San Quentin?
He was at San Quentin Penitentiary.
And what was the name of the song?
The name of the song was Peace to the World.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
We thought it was a little timely for the show to play that one.
Great song.
So we're back, and our show is about restorative justice. We've been talking with Barbara Temporowski, who is part of the planning committee for the 2010 National Restorative Justice Symposium. We're also going to spend the next few minutes talking with Kelly Stankiewicz, who's the coordinator of the VOICE Project for the Regina Alternative Measures Program. Kelly's going to be all excited about telling us about her new program starting and where it came from, what was the need for it. Just tell us all about how wonderful it is, and
okay.
we'll educate the public and educate me too.
Excellent. It's a restorative justice approach to serious crime. We offer an opportunity for victims, offenders, and community members to discuss resolving the impact of the offense by providing support, identifying needs, and exploring concerns for accountability, responsibility, reparation, and safety through a confidential and voluntary process. So our program goals are to offer victims an opportunity to share their story with their offender in a safe environment. And basically, it's a thing about sharing stories. The offender wants to have his story or her story heard, and the victim wants to hear it and ask questions, and things get solved that way.
When an offender wants to have their story heard, would the average person suspect that they want to make excuses for committing a crime, that that's what it would be all about?
Some of it might be, but I do believe by the time they come through the VOICE program, because it's an post-sentence, sometimes post-incarceration even, they have had a lot of time to think about what they've done and how they've hurt people. And when they listen to the victims and the response to the offense by the victim, other things come in their mind, and there may be the odd offender who might be doing this for reasons of mm-hmm. that sort. Mm-hmm. We can't always be sure.
Right.
Victim. We do try. We meet with them. Like I said, I meet with each side many times before bringing both sides together, and a lot of times there could be an inappropriate reason for either the victim or the offender wanting to meet, and in that case we wouldn't go through with the actual meeting.
What type of inappropriate reason?
Well, like you said, for personal reasons, for wanting to get out of jail earlier or something like that, but that would come up in the intakes and
right.
the meetings that I would have with the
okay.
victim or the offender. I do have an overseeing group who I can run things by as well. I'm talking to this person, and this is what they said, and I'm not sure if this is how mm-hmm. they're feeling. And I, so there are a lot of people who are going to help me out in that respect.
I'm just curious, this is maybe something you've already dealt with and I missed it, but the program itself gets initiated at the request of both parties. Is that how that would work?
Either party.
Okay.
So if one party requests it, we would do an intake with that party, mm-hmm. first of all, to find out, to make sure that they're coming into it for the right reasons.
Right.
And then if it does seem that it should go ahead, we would try to find a way to get in touch with the other party. If the victim is referred first and we meet with the victim and it seems like something that we should go through with, it's quite simple to go through the court system to mm-hmm. find out the name and the name of the offender and the whereabouts of that person. It's a little more difficult when the offender is referred first, because we don't want to intrude on the victim and re-victimize
right.
the victim in any way and bring back horrible memories or anything like that.
So what's the biggest problem with that?
Well,
other than I guess maybe in the process, I'm wondering, what's the process if a victim requests this type of meeting? And yes, I can imagine how it could raise issues again for the victim.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the process of contacting the victim?
Oh, we would probably just send out a bunch of information and let the victim know that the offender is interested in meeting with that person and just leave it at that until and give them contact information for them to contact me if they ever find a time when they might be interested.
Mm-hmm. Could I add something to that? I know in BC, in the Community Justice Initiatives Program I mentioned, which has done this work, I think, for something like 30 years and has been evaluated, I believe the way that they handle it is that the facilitators would talk to criminal justice officials like police and so on who are involved in the case and get their sense of whether it might be appropriate to contact the victim. Often the people who dealt with the case would be in the best position to know the circumstances and whether the victim might have any interest at all or whether there might be good reasons to be concerned about the victim's safety and not to even contact them.
Okay. Victim Services is a wonderful place to contact, to talk to about the victims and their reactions and things like that too. So we would work closely with Victim Services as
Go on then.
Kelly, could you maybe tell them a bit, like once you have the referral and you've talked a bit about meeting with them and doing screening and kind of talking about why they want to be there and what they might hope to get from the process, but in terms of assuming that both parties are suitable and they want to go ahead, what are some of the ways that they can get together?
Okay, it doesn't have to be a face-to-face meeting, although those can work and be done really well. We would have support people on either side if they wanted to do a face-to-face meeting, but if it wasn't face-to-face and they weren't ready to look each other in the eye, there's also video conferencing. We can videotape people on their own by themselves. We can write letters or we can pass letters back and forth. We can also do a third party dialogue where one person is in one room and the other person is in the other room and the facilitator goes back and forth between the rooms and kind of passes messages and things like that. We always are very diligent in making sure that the process is safe for everyone.
Okay. How long have you been? Has this program? This program's already started, I gather,
or is it something that's in the works? It's been in pilot mode for a while.
Okay.
We just got the insurance in place, and we do have a lot of partners who are coming together to try to bring in our first referral. We have had a few suggestions of first referrals, but they haven't followed through. We haven't gone through with all of them yet.
Okay. And which partners would that be? Like, would Victim Services be one of them?
Victim
Services. Courts would be another, maybe?
Yes, we have the Crown Prosecution.
Okay.
Probation
Services?
Yes.
Okay.
Probation's Corrections. And of course, Barb and her partner at the government office there are on the advisory committee.
Okay.
We do invite the police services and RCMP. There's also an RCMP victim services involved in our advisory committee, too. Is there somebody I'm missing, Barbara?
I think we have some connections as well to the University of Regina.
Yes.
Yeah, there's been a number of partners involved in this for quite some time. I've been working on this for about a year. And we really wanted to make sure that the program was ready, you know, that that Kelly had the appropriate training and was going to be ready to start taking cases, that there are good procedures and protocols. And now we're at the point where Kelly's going to be starting to actively handle referrals.
This is exciting. I'm excited about this. It's wonderful. I have a question about exclusionary criteria. I see that on your pamphlet here. What would be the criteria for exclusion?
Well, we don't handle child sexual abuse because of the imbalance of power in that case. Drug charges, whether it's possession or trafficking, we don't handle those. And we would drop a case if either the victim or the offender are not willing to participate. It has to be voluntary. We're not going to be coercing anybody into a discussion.
Right.
And it's inappropriate according to the victims. So if the victims aren't ready to meet, then we just won't. We'll set it aside and put it off for a while. But we'll always let them know that we are available if something comes up and they decide that they are ready to meet.
So if a victim is not ready to meet, but the offender has requested some sort of contact for an opportunity to have a dialogue of some sort, where does that leave the offender? Is there any type of support beyond that for the offender who has obviously, to me it would seem, come to a point where they do want to have some sort of a resolution, have an opportunity to maybe express their own feelings and what's been going on with them, and or maybe express a, being sorry and that sort of thing. So what's the process there?
We wouldn't deal with that because the offender would probably go through some counseling or something like that. If an offender came to us and said that he or she wants to talk about guilt and talk about feeling really sorry, if he wants to or he or she wants to write a letter or something like that, we could keep it on file, and we would let the offender know
that it's there.
Right. And if the victim ever wants to read it, it's there for the victim to read.
Okay.
But other than that, we would refer people to counseling.
Okay.
Yeah, there are other restorative justice methods that can be used, though. Like the VOICE program will focus on dialogues between victims and offenders who want to participate.
Right.
But in other situations where, let's say, if the victim wants to participate but the offender does not, then it's possible to do things like healing circles with the victim.
Right.
Where a facilitator would bring in perhaps justice officials who are involved in that case, professionals like counselors who are involved, friends and family members of the victim, and so on. And the victim can speak about what happened during the offense and how it affected them. And the group will talk about the need for healing and how each of them can assist the victim in the future.
Okay.
Now, if the offender wants to participate but the victim does not, then it's also possible to do things such as these things like circles of support and accountability, or sometimes communities have what are sometimes called releasing circles or healing circles to signify that the offender is trying to start a new life and is returning to the community, trying to change their behavior and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So the ideal in restorative justice is that all three parties would be involved, the victim, the offender, and communities.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, you know, it's not appropriate to involve all three, or people have the absolute right not to participate if they don't want to. So we still would try to find other ways to address those needs, even if one or more party doesn't want to participate.
Okay. All right.
I'd like to add, too, that the Regina Alternative Measures Program, which is offering the new VOICE project, has a lot of experience in handling cases with restorative justice. So they've been handling property matters and assaults for many, many years. Kelly herself is a facilitator who has experience in those cases. And it's so important that people who work in the restorative justice field have training so that they can make sure they screen cases appropriately and ensure that victims' needs are met and people aren't re-victimized. And that's even more important when you're dealing with more serious matters like we're talking about here. And that's why the steering committee for the VOICE project has spent a lot of time trying to work consultatively together and get the project ready. And Kelly has a lot of training and experience, so we're confident now that it's time to launch the program, start looking for referrals. And I'm personally really excited to see this happening here in Saskatchewan.
Oh, I think it's exciting also. What else did you want to tell us about your program?
The purpose is to assist in the healing of victims, offenders, and their respective families and communities. We want to offer the opportunity for victims and offenders to discuss the crime, its effects, obtain answers, questions, express feelings, and participate as in part of a healing and recovery process.
What do you see this type of program doing for the future of the criminal system, the criminal justice system? Do you see in the near future or in the far-flung future big changes in the criminal justice system if something like this is in place? During the process of someone going through charges, having charges laid, going through court, being incarcerated, how do you see this affecting all of that?
That's a really interesting question and a very big one, Mona. Again, I'd say that from my experience across the country, here in Saskatchewan, we've already started to have a very significant shift at using community-based justice programs of all kinds.
So here we have a lot of victim services, these community justice, restored justice, Aboriginal justice programs. We have Aboriginal court worker programs. There's community policing going on. So there's all kinds of community-based justice work happening here in Saskatchewan already. A lot of other places in the country, and of course many other countries in the world, don't yet have that level of community-based justice work occurring. So I think that's actually the first step to have increasing community involvement in these matters and increasing justice programs that engage the community in restorative justice and victim services and other kinds of processes. Mm-hmm. Going beyond that to even bigger justice reform, I often tell my students that someday one of them goes on to do a master's or a PhD and look at how we could actually have a restorative justice approach throughout policing or corrections or the legal system, that would be one of the most important pieces of research anyone could do. I'm not aware of anyone who's really gone in depth to say what would it look like, and practically speaking, how would those aspects of the justice system function in a restorative justice model within the law and in partnership with all the other agencies in the justice system. So if any of your listeners have the background to do that work, you know, I would really encourage them to do that. The closest I've seen is a book called Justice as Sanctuary by Herman Bianchi. I think that came out in the 1990s, and he was talking for kind of a parallel system of justice where people could opt into kind of a more of a restorative justice model. But again, maybe some of your listeners would know if there are books in this field that really tell us what that model would look like in a practical way. I would love to hear of that. If there are any, I certainly haven't seen any.
Okay.
Restorative justice has always been looked at as an alternative to the court system, and ideally what I would like to see happen is restorative justice be the court way of dealing with things, and have the way the court system is dealing with things now be the alternative.
Oh, I'm just sitting here. I'm just sitting here daydreaming a little bit and dreaming in Technicolor. I could see a situation in which you have different levels of restorative justice, starting at your police officer. And to a certain extent, I think that happens already. If you have a police officer who is really engaged with the people that he's policing, and he ends up in a situation perhaps dealing with minors or whatever, and he doesn't have to fill out a report, he doesn't have to put the child in the system, and he intervenes at that point and finds a way, you know, to get things to happen in a positive direction. So there you've stopped the situation right at that point. Mm-hmm. And so then it's sort of in layers. This is the way, like, I'm dreaming in Technicolor here. But isn't that the sort of the direction that we want to go in? And then you end up with a situation in which the only people that are in prison are the people who are truly dangerous, for which there's no other alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the reason why Saskatchewan handles more cases with restorative justice than any other province in Canada, up to 5,000 or 6,000 cases every year, is because there are an increasing number of police officers and Crown prosecutors who are supportive and who do refer cases. Mm-hmm. And I think Jim has really hit the nail on the head when he says there are also cases where people really are dangerous, where they're not willing to accept responsibility, mm-hmm. right. where it's not safe to have them in the community. And mm-hmm. in my personal view, which not everyone would share, but in my view, I think there is going to be always being a need for the correction system to deal with that, and also a need for a legal system to address cases where mm-hmm. people want to assert their innocence. That's a fundamental right, and we shouldn't assume that every single case is going to be appropriate for restorative justice.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
I think once police officers are involved in an alternative measure in a restorative justice process, and it turns out to work out well, that's when their minds get changed and they start
right.
to refer to mm. us. But I do believe too that it starts in an elementary school, not just at the police level, but down
right.
at the
oh, sure.
at the level of children, and that's why I was really happy to see restorative justice being practiced in the elementary schools.
Excellent. How much time do we have, Jim?
Oh, we've got way more, about 7 minutes
okay.
roughly.
What about gender issues? I wanted to sort of bring this up. Gender issues in restorative justice, as far as female criminals versus male criminals, and how does this work? Do you have any research, and sort of where are you at with this? We know that there's a much higher incidence of First Nation women in the criminal justice system in our country and in many colonized countries. What kind of picture have you got of this, and how it reflects within the restorative justice process?
Yeah, that's an area which has had a lot of calls for research. I think it's something we don't know much about yet. For example, perhaps others who are listening to this might have this background that I don't, but I'm not aware of research looking at the different experiences of women and men in restorative justice programs. And I think that is something that we need to do. Absolutely. I think, though, one aspect of gender issues in restorative justice that has received a lot of attention is whether it's appropriate to use restorative justice in cases of domestic violence and sexual assault.
Right.
And that's particularly difficult, potentially problematic because of the dynamics of abuse, of the ongoing nature of abuse, and so on.
Power and control issues.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's something that restorative justice has been used successfully by a few programs around the world in those cases. But I'd want to emphasize that, again, the practitioners need such a high level of training and sensitivity to victim issues that those cases would always have to be approached very, very carefully. And that this is an area that continues to be contentious, and certainly not everyone is comfortable with this. Mm-hmm. We don't handle family violence cases here in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. I am certainly aware of these dynamics you mentioned about Aboriginal women in the criminal justice system, and many of those women are women with children, which also presents a lot of other problems. Often I think female offenders are people who are very poor, and the crimes are often related to fraud and other kind of issues related to poverty. So there's a lot of work to be done there in terms of preventing people from getting into the justice system in the first place.
Right.
And I was just thinking, too, that I think you have to pick the time at which you disengage very carefully, particularly when you have a complicated case. You know, you can't just sort of cut them loose. They have to have that support.
Yeah, that goes back to the importance of preparation and screening, and the fact that, as Jim says, you can't just let people loose when they've suddenly maybe unloaded a lot of very personal stuff. They probably would need a lot of support, even if it doesn't go to a dialogue like the kind that Kelly's involved in.
Mm-hmm. Just to end the show, I think I would like to move on to international developments. We kind of like to do that here on this show. It's start local and go global. What did we learn at the symposium about international developments? Well, I guess maybe I'll ask what was the most exciting thing for you to learn or to be able to talk about here on the show about.
We were so pleased to have an expert from Ukraine, a man named Roman Koval, come to the symposium and give a workshop on his experience about implementing restorative justice in the Ukraine and their criminal justice system. I was so interested to learn that the Ukraine, being an Eastern Bloc country, had no history of community development or community programming. Apparently it was even illegal to belong to any kind of community group. So it's been a lot of work, and Canadian experts, officials, and volunteers have been going to Ukraine to help them develop these programs, and they're really making progress with starting to take cases and also developing justice centers in the Ukraine. So that was very interesting. And the use of restored justice is spread in countries all over the world, from Jamaica through to Britain, where it's going very strongly. There's a city in the United Kingdom called Hull, which is aimed to be the world's first fully restorative city. And apparently they've trained 5,000 people from police through social workers through teachers in using restorative justice in all aspects of their work. So that's a city that's doing really exciting things.
Wow, that is exciting. Oh, what about the costs? Compared to throwing people in jail, what are the costs involved in the training and the, okay, I've got 2 minutes left. Just give us a little bit of what your thoughts on that.
I think we suspect that the costs of using restorative justice are far, far lower, because I'm sure when you ask the question, you know that the cost of incarcerating someone is in tens and tens of thousands of dollars, depending on what system you're talking about. But it's hard to – there's been not very much research about the exact costs. It's hard to pin those down.
Yeah.
But we do definitely know that the cost per case in restorative justice is generally considerably lower.
Maybe they'll have some information from Hull – you know, in 10 years from now, that we could use. I mean, we've been trying to do this for years. I mean, when it comes to homelessness, when it comes to justice, and the variety of issues, and sort of, you know, talk about how the cost is negated in when you go to a different formatting. You know, when you're trying to do something a little bit different, that is probably better for everybody, as you say, for the victims, for the perpetrators, and for the community. So we're going to head out. And thank you, Barb Tomprowski and Kelly Stankiewicz, for being on our show today. It's been wonderful having you, and we're looking forward to a great future in restorative justice.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks. We're pleased to be here today.
Mm-hmm. And thank you, Mona, very much. Mona Hill and myself, Jim Hutchings, are Amnesty International volunteers. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Our goal is to increase the awareness of and contribute to discussion of human rights issues at home and around the world. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or check out our Facebook group at Amnesty International Saskatchewan and follow the links. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."